This conference will now be recorded.
If you have any questions, please send them through the chat function. Dr. Young, if you look to your right on your screen, you should have the chat function up. Both you and Dr. Slimp can see the questions that have already been posed. If Heather gets any emails, she's going to put them on the chat function as well. So anybody who's just a caller, you can send an email to info@wvsma.org. That being said, Dr. Young, go right ahead.
Hi, I'll go ahead and start. I'm actually barring John Law from State Medical at the moment to assist me, as well as barring his computer for the evening. So first of all, everyone, thank you for joining. It's a pleasure to be with State Medical folks again. I'm sorry it's been so long that we've been able to see each other in person. But as the active president and as the Kanawha Charleston Health Department health officer and executive director, it's also a pleasure to join you this evening. It's great to see my counterpart at the state, Dr. Slemp, who I always appreciate. And I know she's counting the days up as well as we are. So here at Health Command, we are at day 33 of operations. And so what Health Command is at the Kanawha Charleston Health Department is an operation where we are in a room side by side with the Kanawha County Emergency Ambulance Authority, 911, other emergency operations, CAMC. We have the county sheriff's office with us at all times. And so it's basically a joint operation so that we can address issues within the county very quickly. We have 180,000 people that we're trying to care for in the COVID epidemic, and we absolutely do our best to try to fulfill the needs of each and every individual. We have consulted several times with the mayor as well as the county officials that we are working with. We've had a lot of support that we wouldn't be able to do the things that we did if we weren't working together as a health command. So I have a great team behind me. We've been together 33 days now, and I don't see in the foreseeable future that we'll be parting ways anytime soon. We have conference calls twice a day with our city and county leadership, as well as I think I may have used up all of my minutes dialing up Dr. Slemp at the state and on separate issues as well. But it's very important that we have those partnerships moving forward for our community. Besides our close work with the city and county, we have weekly conference calls with the mayors across the county. I think that's a good way to stay connected. We have routine calls with the volunteer fire departments 3 times a week to update them on situations. We work routinely with the Emergency Operating Command Center at 911 at least 4 times a day. And so it's really, it's been quite an operation here. Right now we have a 24-hour-a-day hotline at the Kanawha Charleston Health Department to address COVID issues. And that's everything from general questions about should I get tested? Can I get tested? Where can I get tested? What does it look like? Am I at risk? What is isolation? And so we've dealt with a lot of these issues at the Kanawha County level. We've even had to institute at least 4 quarantine orders, which at this point have now been lifted. So that of course takes a lot of time and effort, a lot of research, a lot of cooperation with the prosecutor's office as well as the sheriff's office to get these orders in place for the good and the safety of our public. As far as what we've been able to do, we've tested more than 200 people inside our clinic with the assistance of the Office of Laboratory Services from the state, as well as some commercial partners. As of 3 p.m. today, I'll go ahead and report out the numbers. We have had 93 positives within Kanawha County, and that is Kanawha County residents. That doesn't necessarily reflect the census at CAMC. We have, through epidemiologic tracing, been able to close 50 of those cases, which is good news. People are on the mend, which is what we like to hear. And we do have 43 open cases. Our EPI staff is aided by the National Guard, as well as volunteers from the county to help us keep the contact tracing, which I'm sure that Dr. Slemp will touch on as an essential public health function. We see that, but we've been able to keep our contact tracings with about 10 active clusters, and we have routine calls and relationships with CAMC and Thomas to keep our facilities up and running. So things to plan for the future, we've planned for the surge. What we are seeing now, at least at the county level, and I'll let Dr. Slemp speak more to the state, is that we're seeing a little more activity in nursing homes, which has been of concern. which could be a potential surge into the hospitals. But we're on the phone about these issues earlier today. We'll be on the phone again. I'm sorry, Dr. Slemp, probably even after this. But that's what we've been working here at Kanawha Charleston. With that, I'm happy to send it over to Dr. Slemp. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And it is wonderful to be here with State Medical and to co-host with you. There is absolutely, this is a partnership, both state and local public health departments. And as Sherry mentioned, we are on the phone regularly at all hours of the night and day. I really appreciate that partnership. And we are trying to work to do that across the state with all of our local partners. I don't even know what day it is now. We're probably at the state level somewhere in 66, 70 because we began back in February with the travel bans to China and people coming into the state and then doing that following of travelers. So it is all a blur in my mind, but it is very active. Sherry spoke to the partnerships, and I have to say that is absolutely what it's all about. So we are working very closely with the National Guard, with Dr. Marsh, with across DHHR, not just in the Bureau of Public Health, but with our Bureau of Children and Families and the implications for foster children and adult protective services, with Medicaid, the Bureau of Medical Services, and the impacts on the opportunities they have to address issues, OFLAC, behavioral health. This has just become truly an all of community response. And as you know, it has changed all of how we function as society in reality and how we our economy. Something that has truly been absolutely unprecedented. We continue to work with our healthcare system partners, hospital association, state medical association, primary care, behavioral health, long-term care. There's been a lot of work around long-term care. I'll speak more of tonight. Just a ton of trying to have all of us stay up to date and to really have these public health systems that can both partner with and provide information to the various sectors that there are, and to hear back from folks so we really can adjust and move forward together. So this is why I always love these kinds of forums, because besides just sharing information, we really, my favorite part is to stop and listen and hear. I'm just gonna, we currently have been doing a ton around contact tracing, as well as testing. And that is, those are both areas that will be critical as we move past this first surge or this first wave. And so at this point, as you may know, we are up to about 718 confirmed cases statewide. We know there are probably plenty more that are either very mild and never detected or asymptomatic. But we're officially at 718, with over 17,821 test results received. So you can tell that testing has been increasing. It is not the place that we'd like it to be, but it has been improving with that. Sadly, we've had 12 deaths to date, and we have seen that pick up in the last few days. So I think we are kind of seeing ourselves increasing a little bit from that angle. If you look at the projections, we've mostly followed, I think I've shared with many of you before, some models from the University of Washington. IHME is projections you can Google and find. And that is a very interesting model that tends to keep pushing our surge a little day or two ahead of us. So we are right at the area that in this week that they say we are going to be having our kind of peak with this wave in terms of our healthcare system. But again, that extends, this is not going to suddenly be over. It definitely extends out a few months continuing as we, but hopefully continue to decrease. We'll have to see what actually happens with that. But I think longer term, we have to think about the fact that this may not be a single, and probably will not be a single wave with this. And sometimes you see multiple waves. Sometimes we have to think about as we begin to release some of the community mitigation measures that we may have to kind of watch what happens to disease and then put things up and down and do some titration back and forth. But that speaks to the importance of laboratory testing and contact tracing and having good data to know what the implications are when we make those releases. So I'm going to just share a couple of things that are emerging here that I hope you will be seeing in the next day or two, if we can get this health alert out. And we can speak some to tonight if you have questions around them. And that is that there's a health alert coming out. Well, there's a health alert coming out with some clinical guidance that we have worked with the three universities and some other experts in terms of pulmonologists and infectious disease around the state to just kind of give some information about how folks in our state that are expert in this arena really are approaching clinical treatment, especially of our most ill individuals. So that will be coming out shortly. That health alert will also have some information on PPE and saving your PPE, because the Guard is developing a system by which they can collect that. They can then put it through a vaporized hydrogen peroxide process that they have done some quality assurance on to make sure that actually that does sanitize them and allow for reuse as one of the strategies that we're using to make sure there is sufficient supply as we move forward. And then the third area with that health alert will be death reporting and the importance of formally reporting deaths to the local health department in the state, so that we really have an accurate number and impact of this event moving forward, continuing to move forward. We get that now, but it's just going to get some information out about it to our providers. And then the other arena that we have been working on lots and working with the long-term care, the Healthcare Association, the long-term care partners, has been some written guidance around, or some updated guidance around investigation of nursing home outbreaks. We have had, I think at this point, probably 18 outbreaks at least, across the state overall. And the vast majority, 3/4 of those, I think 14 or some of them, have been related to long-term care facilities. So this is the area that we regularly are seeing identify and come up. It's a concerning one because of the vulnerability of that population. And we are, frankly, learning as we go in terms of managing them. And so I guess that's one of the things to know about when you have novel and different viruses that are emerging and you're learning as you go, is that you start with one approach and then you see how it applies and you learn more about the virus. And you adapt it, so you will see guidance change. And I think we need to speak to that actually as a positive, because it means we're learning from experience. And so this is one of the areas that I think we are seeing that happen as well. I'm going to stop there, and we can shift over to dialogue and questions and conversation, which is the part I like best. Sherry, We got a couple of questions we can start with, or we can open it up if there's a broader. What's best, Danny?
So the questions were sent well in advance, so why don't you go ahead and start with those?
Okay. The first one says, slowly it appears there is some consensus developing that when the COVID acute lockdown response ends, a period of frequent mass fast testing at employment and other sites will ensue. That will also include rapid contact tracing and early appropriate isolation until an effective drug or vaccine is approved. So I can take a little bit of a stab at that. I don't think we know what it'll look like yet. I know there has been conversation nationally about it being in drug stores and other public sites. That is not operationalized necessarily system-wide around the country at this point. I do think that we'll be in a phase that it's going to be really important to have really good surveillance data and to understand where we're seeing disease occur. And we know that right now, without a vaccine, our most effective intervention has been our community mitigation measures. But we're trying to learn which ones have the biggest effect and which ones is it okay to release and to let go and to move with. We do know that in some other countries, when they have relaxed some of those measures, they have seen some increases in disease. And we also know that as folks repatriate and come back to their own, have a little more travel, they've seen some changes. So it is a time that is important to have really good surveillance data, that you're balancing the risks and the benefits on the economy to get refunctioning again. And all the other essential things that really have to keep happening as a society. So we wanted to make sure those come forward, but at the same time, as we are relaxing those, that we need to watch what's happening with disease in communities so that it doesn't get ahead of us and we don't overwhelm our healthcare system again with that or, cause unnecessary deaths with this. So it's sort of this concept that we may have to titrate a little while up and down, or that we may actually, we just don't know, see other waves. I mean, frankly, one of the things I think will be really interesting is after we move through this first area, hopefully there will be some better serologic testing available and we can do some testing of our population to see if there's immunity or at least what percent have actually had the disease, because the factors, of course, that will cause increases would be certainly the fact that we are closer together and the spread occurring again, but that only depends on if we have a high percent of our population vulnerable. We've done a really good job of keeping that down as best we can tell, but does that leave our population more vulnerable with a few people having been infected? We don't know long-term immunity with this at this point, and so we will be learning that. And we also know that we have a very high-risk state when disease does occur. So we just have to be very careful and make sure that we are able to have that good surveillance, that good testing ability, and that rapid ability to isolate, quarantine contacts, and prevent spread further. And it's going to be, it's ramping it. We're talking about this nationally. It's ramping it up to a level that already public health is doing unprecedented work right now. And we are talking about ramping that up even further with more testing ability. And so it is going to take partnership with all of us and, probably some extra supports, in many ways, because these are novel and approaches that we've not ever had to do at that level before. Carrie, anything you want to add on that one?
I'll go ahead and take the second half of that. I think you covered that very well. Considering the inability of many locations to, even to be able to effectively address the early prevention in the highest risk institutional settings for the elderly and disabled, how effective will such an approach be in the total communities, especially as concerns about rapid tracing and early intervention, what would it take to make it work? I think that's kind of goes along with what you were talking about as well, as far as having those contact tracings, making sure that we are able to identify these people. And it is tough as far as there is an inability for some locations to effectively address early prevention, but I think that's where public health really shines, is that we get out in front of the problem, we address the problem, we make sure that people are aware of the problem, and sometimes we have to be the educators as well as the consolers, as well as the people going on the front lines, along with all the physicians that are on this call. I can't tell you how much we appreciate you being on the front lines and how many questions you must have, and just know that public health is here at your disposal. We are here to support you. We are here to help you in any way that we can. So we know that when we get a positive case and we're trying to figure out who they've been around and what their risk factors are, trying to keep them isolated or quarantined, that's our piece of it. We know that our healthcare providers are on the front lines doing the work of this every day. And so I don't want to belabor the fact that public health is great and we are really working very hard at every level, but it's really the providers that are making this possible. I just, first of all, want everybody to know that we're here to support you, and especially through the State Medical Association. We're an open door, and everybody at State Medical has that door, has that access to us, and we are absolutely happy to help in any way we can.
I think one of the things, too, is the importance, you know, I worry about, frankly, and this is where our clinicians, I know you, I hear this from you as well, what's not happening in terms of other health prevention efforts right now, mm-hmm. and making sure that we really still have access to making sure that our folks with diabetes are really getting cared for, and our hypertension. And I know we're having to do that in different ways. I worry that we're not able sometimes to pay as much attention to some of the routine public health activities that we want to be doing and need to be doing. So I think we really need to be thinking about in partnership, how do we really sustain the health of our population more broadly in ways that help make us more resilient to COVID-19 and really address the critical health issues that we as a state have before this ever began.
Absolutely. And so things that we need to look at, I mean, this falls on the back of our healthcare providers and the healthcare profession. And so there are things that even within the health department, we realize they have to be done safely, though. And so to kind of piggyback on that idea, yeah, we have other public health functions, but, you know, we don't want to bring somebody in to immunize them and expose them to COVID while we're doing the testing. So we have to be very thoughtful about how that process looks. At the health department, we have now reopened appointments for people to get immunizations, but you drive up, let us know you're here, and we will come out and get your immunizations for you, because we don't want to lose sight of those other things that are going on in our communities.
One of the things I'd invite everyone to do, if I don't know if we can unmute folks, but I think it's helpful if you've got ways that you've been doing that you can share, because I find that the more we can kind of hear from folks in the field about how they're operationalizing things effectively, you know, it's the peer-to-peer stuff that is most helpful, and it's certainly I love to listen to and hear. So
it is great to hear, and there are so many people that are cooperating with public health, and we do appreciate that. One of the problems that we've had actually, you know, and that one of the biggest challenges we've had is, let's just say it, social media, Facebook, and it's been a challenge for us, not only when we're trying to address outbreaks in facilities, as well as even providers and other things, people making these announcements. Is that something that we can look at as a community? Do we need to be doing better education for our providers and other people to know that this hampers the investigation, that this is this isn't something that needs to be fought out on Facebook, that this is part of our internal processes.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to do this in the age of social media.
Yes.
Instantaneous evaluation of everything that's happening.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we're trying to work to unmute folks, and so maybe people can chime in and share some
I will unmute everyone, but I need everybody to know that if we get feedback from you, I'll click you back on mute again. If I hear noise in the background, if your dog's barking and such, we will mute you. We apologize, but I'm going to go ahead and open it up, and everyone, please be nice.
Unmuted. You can always mute yourself when you're not talking.
One's alarm. Hey.
What? Hello?
Yes.
Dr. Felsen, we can hear you.
I'd just like to follow up. Because I think the resources that we're going to need for contact tracing and testing and everything with this, which there seems to be the consensus on the approach, although you get Rahm Emanuel and others that are going to want to keep what we're doing now for 18 months, in which case the economy will be totally gone. But what concerns me is where contact tracing is an art, and as we know, and you get into privacy, and you're dealing with all types of institutions, businesses, public safety, you name it. And I just wonder where we really are with the resources if we go with what seems to be where CDC and others are heading. Now, it'll be selective in different places and slow, depending on a lot of factors. We read all about that, what the criteria would be and the variability. But the fact of the matter is, I have a hard time believing most of our local public health will have the capacity to do that. Meanwhile, I turn around and read the local paper, and I see the little community health center down the road here in Paw Paw gets $500,000. And that's enough money that could do an awful lot to beef up public health contact tracing and follow up and all that stuff. And so I'm more concerned on what we're going to need for resources if we do start to relax and count on the tracing and the heavy testing and tracing and those types of things. And I just want thoughts, if you heard anything. I mean, it seems to me I would have liked to seen a lot of that money go to the public health, because that's what I think is the major thing that's going to have to be done to prevent the spread. Thank you.
Terry, do you want to take that at the local level, and I'll talk about the state level?
I was getting some information from a long-term care facility, so I missed the second part of that. But hi, Dr. Felsen, how are you? But as far as resources, I mean, this is something that we need very much moving forward. The contact tracing has been, while difficult in our situation, has been very essential for us to be able to put out those fires and to be able to continue that. Do we have those resources? Right now, yes, we have those partnerships, but the challenge is, and that you've probably experienced this too, your public health background, the public health gets cut and it gets cut and it gets cut, and then there's an outbreak, and then there's H1N1, or there's an emergency, and now it's a pandemic. And so now at this point, here we are, and we have minimum staff and we have minimum resources and expected to address a pandemic that's absolutely unprecedented. And so are we prepared for it? I think we've been preparing our whole lives for this, but I do think that the resources are limited. It is tough. It is a financial strain. It is a strain on the back of our physicians. It is a strain on the back of our nurses and people who work on the front lines. But yeah, we're gonna have to carry this burden for a while. I'll turn it back over to Dr. Slim.
You know, it's a great question, Jim. It's one that we're thinking about as well and wrestling with. You know, we have a public health system that when nothing happens, nobody pays attention to. And it's quiet and people do a lot of good work. And I think this is an opportunity for all of us to recognize the absolute critical nature that public health systems play. So we truly are, we are being stretched, I think. To ramp up to the speed that we're occurring currently. I do think that what's envisioned is another step beyond that. We are really having to we're having to not look at models that simply are taking what we're doing currently to scale all the time, but how do we temporarily expand workforces? How do we have IT systems that support that and implement those as quickly as we can? We're looking at different outbreak management systems, those kinds of things. Workforce-wise, what we've done so far has been to bring on board some National Guard supports that we put through a whole series of trainings about surveillance and outbreak investigation systems and our IT systems and security and confidentiality systems, because you are absolutely right. Contact tracing and management is an art. And we do it every day on some diseases, STDs and HIV and some other infectious diseases, but nothing to this scale. And so we are having to bring on some other folks that can be, we have our regional epidemiologists, we have the local department starts with this, and they're using volunteers as well that they are training in many settings. We have regional epidemiologists that we're supplementing with some National Guard supports. We're actually now doing some training with some occupational medicine faculty and residents to potentially add some additional supports. So again, we are trying to think creatively about how to do this, and we don't have all the answers yet. And it is going to be a mix of workforce and IT and figuring out other creative novel ways. We're talking the same thing about with other states. I do think that it is an opportunity, and we have to think about it as an opportunity to build our public health system every day and strengthen the partnerships that we have with our healthcare providers and our communities, because this is why you want a strong public health system. And this is one example of that. But there, with a stronger public health system, we can do other things that are also equally as impactful, long term for the health of our state. So I just think we have to keep that objective in mind in the longer term. Other thoughts? What, from the clinical angle, what are you all experiencing and what issues are coming up? And
Dr. Smith? Hello?
Yes.
Hi, it's Jim McJunkin, and Sherry too. I'm sort of concerned about whether city parks are going to open as one of the earlier things that would change. Maybe it's a question for tomorrow night, but do you have any sense of that? It seems to me it's an area where social distancing is very doable, and we're really hampering for families kind of their mental health and that sort of thing, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a great question. It is one that those have just been decisions made locally for the most part. But they often were made because they felt like they weren't getting used in ways that were as safe as they'd like them to be. But I think we as a society have got to learn how to do that. And I fully concur that it's springtime, people need to get out. We need to be able to do that in safe and effective ways in those settings. And so I think as long as, you know, those are local decisions and how those get made. But I would love to see, that more because, I mean, you know, there's nothing against going out and doing a park. There's nothing like going out and taking a walk. I've been dreaming about it every day that I just don't have the time to do it. But, you know, there is something about nature that is rejuvenating and lifts all of our spirits and our hearts and just the physical activity of it. So, and the family time with it. So I totally concur that we need to be able to figure out ways to do that and to model that and to make it work effectively.
Okay. Well, I won't pick up any more. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to kind of go with what Dr. Slump was saying as well, is that yes, the open air is great and it's great for people to get exercise. It's more not the areas of the parks themselves, but the jungle gyms and the gymnasium, people playing basketball, where there's areas of people congregating, and it was becoming a problem because it was routine that we would get calls, 15, 20 people on a basketball court. They're routinely having kids playing on jungle gyms and so on and so forth. And so it was in the interest of their safety. I think we'll look at those things again as we either come out of this or what is going to happen over the next several months. But by no means would we discourage any outside activities. Trails, walking down your street, all of that's highly encouraged. I'm going to quote the great C.W. Sigmund of Kanawha County, said that not everything that's come out of this has been bad. He noticed the other night that he sees more of his neighbors out walking and walking with their kids, and they're not congregating, but they're outside. And so, you know, it gives us a new appreciation of the things that we may have taken for granted before. We never thought about going to the park. We never thought about being outside. And I, like Dr. Slump, who we both probably need vitamin D supplements at this point, long for those days. And we'll get there. But we need to think about ways to open these places responsibly. People understand the safety issues involved, that it's not going outside that's the problem. It's the congregating, and with community spread, and now we're seeing asymptomatic spread and a lot of other things that are really going to determine our course over the next several months. Those are things we need to be thinking about. But absolutely a wonderful question. Thank you, Dr. McJunkin.
Thank you.
I'm wondering in the clinical arena, Sherry mentioned things that we're doing in different ways and we're learning different things that may not all be bad. And I'm wondering in the clinical arena what your experience has been like with some of the telemedicine or other kind of different ways you've been doing things. Have there been things you've learned or positive around those arenas, challenges? What are we learning as a healthcare system in this?
This is Dr. Kearns. Can you hear me?
I can, Fred. Hello.
Hey. Two things I'd point out sort of just clinical wise is I think diarrhea is greatly underestimated on our screening aspects, and I'd strongly point out that a lot of these people, maybe a 20 or 30% easily, have an unrelenting diarrhea that may fool you. You may not focus so much on the chest as the diarrhea. The second thing is the very prolonged vent status. I think we have 7 on the vent right now, and many of those are 3 weeks out or more. And so the damage was done, the virus is gone, but the vent dependence is still there. So you have to anticipate that prolonged length of stay, which begets line infection, C. diff, MRSA, pneumonia, all the complications, DVT, bed sores. And so I think you need to keep in mind that the prolonged hospitalization will be very problematic, and resources will be needed.
Thank you for bringing up both of those. We are starting to look at the case investigation data that we've got. So on the dashboard on the website, if you go through the system, there's about 7 slides on the dashboard. And one of those, I think it's slide number 5, actually lays out what we were seeing in terms of signs and symptoms of the lab-confirmed cases. So it looks like about 77% had cough, 60% fever, 47 myalgia, 45 headache, shortness of breath about 44, sore throats 30%, diarrhea 25%. It was a significant number of people that were having diarrhea as you're reporting. And of course, you may be seeing the more serious ones as well. So you may even have an overrepresentation of that. The other thing that's on that website is the comorbidities that we've been seeing. And so 50% have at least some other underlying pre-existing condition. 21% almost had cardiovascular disease, 14% diabetes, 13 or 14% were former smokers, and several were current smokers or COPD, et cetera. So we're trying to collect that data to learn more as a population. I think it's really interesting when you bring up the ones that you're seeing at the hospital, which we probably ought to look at separately to kind of see what's the clinical manifestations there. So thank you. How are you finding managing them, Fred? What is your best approach to managing them in the hospital?
The pulmonary people have the hard job. We have the simple job since there's really no wonderful therapy. 2 or 3 of these people have come in on hydroxychloroquine, which maybe there's a message there. We haven't had any complications of hydroxychloroquine of significance. Haven't had co-infections. I think just one of them had a MRSA pneumonia. Most of them are just a seemingly pure virus. It's interesting is we have actually the highest seroprevalence in the 45 to 65 year olds as far as frequency of disease, not severity. Probably the older people don't get out as much. We have very, very few in the pediatric population, which is good. So nothing too unusual there. We always keep in mind the proning thing. Even if the person's not on a vent, they may feel better with proning, where they lay on their tummy and the posterior lungs are aerated better. So that's also a last ditch maneuver when you're hypoxic, but even for symptom relief, that may be somewhat helpful.
Really interesting. Yeah, when we look at the surveillance data, that's on slide 2, about 4% of our cases have been under the age of 20. And otherwise, they're kind of across the lifespan. A lot of them at the, well, actually, it's pretty even from about 40 up. So yeah, really interesting.
Dr. Kearns, it's Sherry Young. And so I just wanted to echo, thank you for the discussions that we've had. Definitely CAMC has been a absolute essential ally in our fight here in Kanawha County. And we thank you for all your data and everything that you're doing. But it brings up an interesting fact when you say that someone has a presentation of diarrhea, it brings up several issues. Maybe the improper PPE was worn before they decided that this was a COVID patient. And so multiple layers of symptoms or different presentations can lead to multiple layers of exposure. So that is something that we need to, as a healthcare community, express to our healthcare providers so that they are aware of this and so that they know to be protected. But first of all, Dr. Kearns, thank you for all that you're doing at CAMC. You're doing a wonderful job.
I'd love your thoughts too. You mentioned hydroxychloroquine and others. I know there was a JAMA article just recently looking at kind of what do we know so far about any of the effectiveness of these treatments, what's most promising, and the trials that are underway. I don't know if you want to make any comments around some of that.
We have a team of folks looking at it. They're probably reading this second, things that were probably published about a minute ago. No real great leads in a practical sense. We're working on the plasma, the convalescent plasma availability issues and stuff. One thing, as you mentioned, JAMA, I would point out very strongly, about a week ago, there was a one-page article on what your staff is concerned about, what they're worried about, how you can reassure them. It was the fastest read, most wonderful little paper, and I'd refer everybody to that for staff involvement.
Could you share that with us, or with Danny, you can get it out?
Be glad to.
What is that paper, Fred?
It was a JAMA. It was on the website about a week ago. It was about what is your staff worried about, and it listed probably the top 10 things, and it was very good to go down them. And as I made some presentations, I did that first, and that was the questions that were on people's minds.
Thanks.
That's great. Thank you.
Fred, this is Jack Kinder. I was wondering if you could possibly discuss a little bit the pathophysiology of the hypoxemia. Is this just an overwhelming ARDS type situation, or an autoimmune type thing, or is it pulmonary edema? What is the pathophysiology, if you know or can share that with us?
Let's turn that to you. But I know there's different theories about it. I'd much rather have your opinions with that.
I think we need our intensivists. The biggest thing that impresses me is probably the clotting disorder, the sort of the microthrombi, the D-dimers going up, the coagulopathies, and that fits extremely well to me. But the pulmonary people are much smarter than I. But obviously, it's a lung damage, vascular alveolar flooding type process that's diffuse. But the microthrombi story is to me the most convincing. And your D-dimer goes up, you get diffuse infiltrates, and often coagulation issues otherwhere. You get a lot of post-infectious complications such as MIs and stroke, probably on that exact basis of coagulation activation. You overestimate my knowledge, though.
Anybody else on the call has got some experience or has been reading about things along those lines? Because there are some different theories about why that happens.
Well, isn't the type 2 alveolar cell sort of wiped out, which would affect surfactant and that sort of thing?
Great. What else is coming up for folks, or questions staff have, or other things?
So there's a question to address immunization for routine peds on opening elective surgery.
So we have two questions that come in. One is on routine immunizations for pediatrics. Be happy to talk to you guys on that one. The other one is about reopening for elective surgeries. Yeah. So I will do the pediatrics one, and then we'll talk about the other. Sherry might want to tell you the pediatrics one. You talked about what you were doing with that. I guess from the state level, we do feel this is an essential service. You want to talk about what you're doing there, Sherry, and I can talk about what I'm hearing other places are doing with that?
Absolutely. And so at the beginning of the hour, we shared that, of course, a lot of public health issues are going to the wayside amidst COVID because of staffing and exposure and other issues. So we are now at the Kanawha Charleston Health Department going to take appointments for people to get their immunizations. We think we can do this safely because we have people tested for COVID in their cars, and we will have people immunized in their cars, and we can, we have right now the appropriate amount of PPE to keep everyone well protected. Of course, we know that I'm a huge advocate of immunization, so of course that's on first and foremost on our minds going forward with pediatric immunizations. If there are any physician offices or physicians struggling with the immunization piece, let us work with you. You can contact me through the State Medical Association or through the Kanawha-Charleston Health Department, and I'm happy to get those arrangements for you. Because while children may or may not, depending on what you read or hear, be going back to school this year, we will have a new school enterers for next year, and we don't want to be behind the eight ball trying to catch everybody up on their immunization. So we're working at it here at the Kanawha-Charleston Health Department, but I'm sure they're doing addressing this at the state as well.
Yeah, this to me is an area I kind of feel passionate about, I have to say. You know, we have strong school immunization laws, and so we have high rates at our school entry pieces of school entry ages. But if you look at our two-year-old immunization rates, they're not always that high. And so I really worry about the fact that we're not always, even in everyday practice, getting our kids absolutely age-appropriately immunized. And the last thing that we need is measles on top of COVID. And so it is really important that we really focus on and make sure that we do maintain those immunization levels and that we do get our kids immunized at age-appropriate times. So in fact, today, I think the AAP put out some guidance to really emphasize this point as well. And so you can find that on the AAP website. And they are again, also emphasizing the insurance that continued care for children during the pandemic is being undertaken, especially the immunization arena. So we've got, we know it may look a little different. A lot of the well-child visits may be done more by telehealth or having discussions with parents, or those areas that you can, but so that you can simply minimize the time period when they're back in the office or coming out to see you for the immunizations themselves. But so it might look a little different, but I know there are places that are doing it, for example, as Sherry mentioned, in the child in the car. Or there are folks that are doing it with, well visits in the morning, and anybody sick in the evening with special cleanings afterwards and that kind of thing. So there's different ways to do it, but we have to keep our kids immunized. And yeah, let's let Lisa speak too with that.
Sorry, this is Lisa Costello. I'm the treasurer for State Medical, and thanks to Dr. Young and Dr. Slemp. They're both inspiring to work with and really for public health. But I'm a pediatrician by trade, and I think that's another important part in the pediatric vaccine discussion that came up on one of our national AAP calls is that we are all optimistic we will eventually have a vaccine for COVID, and we need to make sure that we maintain strong immunization practices so that when we have that vaccine, we can deploy it quickly and make sure that those systems don't lax during this time, because when we have a vaccine available, we want to be able to rapidly deliver it to the population. And if we have allowed during this time of COVID for our immunization structures to deteriorate, when we have a vaccine for COVID, we might be in a tricky spot of trying to then catch up to be able to deploy that vaccine. So I thought it was an interesting perspective that I personally had not really taken into account, but I think it's very important when we're talking about primary care's role in this and making sure that we still keep those structures in place so that when we do have an optimistic COVID vaccine, we're going to be able to deliver it. And primary care is the prime pediatricians, family practice, or the prime immunizers along with health departments. So I thought that was an interesting point in the whole underlying the ongoing importance of making sure we're vaccinating kids and those who are due for their vaccines.
It's a really important point. Thank you, Lisa.
And then elective surgeries.
Oh, and then the other one is elective surgeries. I wish I had crystal balls. I don't know. I mean, I'd love your all's thoughts on that and how to best bring that back and what timing with that. So what we need to kind of, what are our triggers you need to think about with that? I'd love people's thoughts on that. These are tough. They're tough calls with this. You know, a lot of it had to do with kind of decompressing the healthcare system and assuring we had PPE and other kind of things available, and staffing for a surge and those types of things. So I think as we move past what may be kind of some of that urgent area and impact on the healthcare system, which we hope we do. Maybe there's opportunities. Those are the times we can actually think about how to redo that. I don't know the exact timing with that, but it's an important piece to figure out. So again, thoughts, we're certainly love to hear.
For elective surgeries, I think there is a bigger piece that will eventually impact public health. Think about cancer screenings that are not going on, pap smears, mammograms, not necessarily mammograms, but colonoscopies and other procedures that need to be happening. And so while we're battling COVID, other things are out there and lurking. And so we need to be very thoughtful as a healthcare community. While Dr. Slimp and I can handle Kanawha and West Virginia, we really need the people on the front lines. And that's definitely our state medical family to be looking at this and finding good ways, efficient ways to address this, because we don't want to have another crisis amid a pandemic. And that is something we need to consider moving forward. That's my thoughts on the elective surgery process.
Yeah, and we really need your judgment of what's elective and what's not with that, because you know your patients and what's the impacts long term if you don't do those.
Well, and this is Brooke Buckley, and I actually was the one who texted in the question. A general surgeon was on a call with a bunch of surgeons around the country last night, and what was interesting, and the reason I asked in this forum, is that things like hernia, back surgery, hip surgery also ultimately are going to start to reflect in workforce and people's ability to get back to work, and people are experiencing even potentially quasi-emergent surgeries that are becoming very high acuity because nobody wants surgery right now. And so that reentry of which ones can we do, how should we do it reasonably, and if we're finding ways to not transmit COVID in the emergency, in the OR, like you all said, stratifying, truly, truly elective and sort of urgent for other life and public health reasons, I think is something we really need to get our brains around so that the backlog doesn't become so extensive. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Slim, Dr. Young, we've met our 1 hour, and this will be recorded and put out there. If anybody has further questions for either Dr. Slim or Dr. Young, you can send them to info@wvsma.org, and we'll make sure that they get those. And then in the coming weeks, I know both of you are going to be on other calls with other people, and we'll obviously host some going on to make sure that everybody has a chance to hear from you and can feed you back with the information that you need to hear. So thank you all very much, and thank everyone for their time.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you on the front lines. Take care.